Hi, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. Today's guest is beyond special to us. Years ago, I published a book called Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, which was an anthology of essays by top reporters writing about their personal encounters with censorship and...
Can I just say something about that? I think 15 years before I met you, how many years ago did you write it?
I don't know. Okay, a million.
For many years, I've been telling people, you got to read this book, you got to read this book.
Oh, thanks. Well, if I were to update this book, Mr. Patrick Lawrence would be in there. I mean, this is a guy, he's a writer and columnist, very distinguished writer, columnist, journalist. This is a guy who was an overseas columnist for nearly 30 years, writing for the New Yorker, International Herald Tribune, and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's done reportage, commentary, essays, criticism, and reviews in the New York Times, Business Week, Time, the Washington Quarterly, World Policy Journal, The Globalist, The Nation, Asian Art. I mean, this is a guy who's a... pro, and as I said, beyond a pro, he's a distinguished guy. And he ran into the buzzsaw on this DNC hack, not a hack story. And the amazing thing about Patrick Lawrence is he saw it from day one.
Saw it upriver.
He saw it. And he wrote a brilliant piece called Shades of the Cold War, How the DNC Fabricated a Russian Hacker. And that was the beginning of his buzzsaw experience. So we are inviting him on this show today. This show is a home for people who have stories like this. And we're just going to let him tell his story and talk about the articles that he wrote and what happened. Welcome, Patrick.
Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you very much. Quite a generous introduction. Greatly appreciated.
Well, you know, facts only over here. So it's all true. So could you talk about your article, the first article that you wrote, The Shades of Cold War, for Salon?
Yeah, like how you saw it.
I remember that morning very distinctly. I think it was... I think it was a Monday because in warm weather, summer, because Robbie Mook had been on the Sunday talk shows, two of them, which I found curious in itself because typically one might be on one show, but so it suggested some kind of choreography. In any event,
you have to tell the audience Robbie Mook was Clinton's campaign.
The campaign manager for Hillary Clinton in 2016. I beg your pardon.
Right. Several days previous, the
DNC mail incident had occurred. And it was plain that quite a lot of damaging information was going to come out. And Robbie Mook came on. I think it must have been Friday evening or Saturday that the mail incident was revealed, because he was on the talk shows, I remember remarking in the column, within 24 hours. So, it struck me as quite weird that he was able to hold forth on Russian culpability in so short a time. it was the correspondent in me that reacted to this whole thing, the reporter's instinct, basically. And he was able to explain that the Russians were responsible for this and were very concerned about it, right? He was quoting our experts, okay? If any reporter listening to your program will tell you that that's sort of a, not really a red flag, but something approaching it. Who are they, right?
And, yeah, who are their experts? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. None of them named. And finally, the detail that sent me straight to my computer was that he was not only pointing the finger at the Russians, but explaining that his experts also have told the Democratic Party the motivations of the Russians, right? The motivations of the Russians. The motivations of the Russians
they
were supposed
fast,
to be to assist Donald Trump to become president, okay? Of course, you step back and say, that tipped me over the edge because it's completely impossible for, and I don't care who the expert is, it matters not. It's impossible for an expert to explain the motivations of somebody who did something like this in a matter of 24 hours. It became ridiculous. So that's what sent me to my keyboard. And I remember ripping that column out in a matter of a couple of hours. It just came out like spring water. Ray McGovern, the noted whistleblower, did some research with a friend, I think last year, maybe earlier this year, who was the first to call Russiagate a fraud. And so far as one can make out, it was that column, right? When Ray told me that, I went on social media and I said, let's start a contest. I'll figure out the rewards later, but if anybody can come forward with an earlier mention, please do. And no one did. So it was a big moment for me. I was very pleased with that column. And it's proved out.
So precious. You know? Well, I'll tell you, I'd just like to read the first paragraph of this column.
Yeah, I love
of
that.
This column.
I love that first
it's
paragraph.
So brilliant.
I must confess to you, I had a good time writing that column, too.
And the brilliance of this is you literally show how they deflected what they were doing, which was stealing the nomination from Bernie.
Yeah, no mention of that. That's
on
what
to...
Wait a minute. You're not at all concerned about what's in the emails?
Right.
We've been stuck with that trope for the last 3 years. Nobody has ever mentioned what's in the emails.
Well, these people are masters of deflection and projection.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's so fascinating that they say, oh, the Russians are trying to get Trump elected, because what's being exposed are their emails that are trying to get Hillary elected by getting Bernie out of the way and planning operations to get Bernie out of the way. So I just want to read the first chapter, the first paragraph. This is Patrick Lawrence. Now wait a minute, all you uppercase D Democrats. A floodlight suddenly shines on your party apparatus, revealing its grossly corrupt machinations to fix the primary process and sink the Sanders campaign. And within a day, you are on about the evil Russians having hacked into your computers to sabotage our elections on behalf of Donald Trump, no less. Is this a joke? Are you kidding? Is nothing beneath your dignity?
You can tell how I was feeling, right?
I wanted to ask you straight off, how did your editor respond? How did the Nation itself respond? What was the original reaction?
It didn't appear in the Nation. That column appeared in Salon.
It's a Salon article.
Forgive me.
Yeah.
No, not at all. They read it, you know. At that time, I began at Salon with quite a good editor named Dave Daly. But by the time that ran, if memory serves correctly, Salon had entered a rather choppy, uncertain phase, and aforementioned Dave Daly had left. And those who replaced them were several and not very long-lasting. So at that point, they were just what we call shoveling copy. You know, the copy came in and it was published, and I didn't hear anything back one way or the other about it.
Okay.
A good question, but no reaction at all.
You also mentioned in the article that the New York Times picked up on Mook's announcement and went right with it. Again, unnamed sources and qualifiers, and point out that there were unnamed sources and qualifiers in the New York Times reporting. So the New York Times was on board.
Well, that's how they do it. It's the snowball.
I mean, it's like the Judith Miller of this.
And then it becomes like a
Russiagate
it's like
situation.
An incarnated media being, this new fake truth.
Well, I mean, we have been up to our ears in unnamed sources, experts or officials or whom you may have, ever since that time, haven't we?
Yes.
All that we now gathered together as Russiagate, I invite your listeners to consider, go have a look, is based on unnamed sources. I'll underscore that, all of it, right?
Wow.
The Times, sort of big legacy newspaper, is trading on its reputation here, right?
Yep.
It's conduct, it's reporting and publishing of all that has to do with Russiagate has been grossly irresponsible. I think any journalism professor in America worth his cap and gown would agree with that, providing said professor looked at the case with proper disinterest detachment. And this is, but basically the Times is in effect consuming itself, okay? It's trading on its legacy and its reputation, but and in so doing considers itself licensed to behave quite irresponsibly.
Yeah.
But what I mean by consuming itself is it's destroying its reputation and its legacy in the course of this. I've mentioned many times in several times in columns. Does the American press think that when Donald Trump is gone and we're back in another political universe, that all of this is going to be forgotten and they can return to ordinary professional standards and ethics? I don't think so. What I'm getting from readers quite consistently now and for some time is the Times and let's call it the whole legacy press, okay, the main broadcasters included, have lost a very significant measure of credibility, right?
A big chunk of credibility
among sane people.
A big chunk of credibility fell off during the run-up, during the run-up to the Iraq War. A big chunk. And now,
yes.
And now it's being followed by this, and people are watching this. And, it's deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. And it's and now it's to affect, I don't know if you want to call it a coup or whatever you want to call it, but now it's affecting whether a president retains his seat or not. Whether you think this guy's terrible or you love him or whatever.
Yeah. Democracy itself is at stake.
Yeah. And, could you talk about the context, the historical context in which you placed this first article that you did? Because I think it's very interesting.
Please explain a little what you mean by historical context.
Well, you're talking about the Cold War. You're talking about, you know, making Russia the enemy.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. I'm actually writing a long essay now about the press and what has befallen it. It's all its self-inflicted damage. I'm starting that piece during the Cold War. Okay, I think the American press had a very bad Cold War. I'm not suggesting it had any kind of golden age prior to the Cold War decades. I don't think much of golden ages. Certainly not in the case of the American press. But it really stumbled very badly during the Cold War in acquiescing to the demands of power and the waging of the Cold War against the Soviets. Okay, and in my view, it never recovered. It never recovered from that. Jumping forward somewhat, a number of other things ought to be looked at, but let's the Reagan administration, for example. But let's jump forward and go to 2001. I think that date was extremely important to what we're talking about now, because the press acquiesced once again as the Bush administration declared a war on terror.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, yep.
If you declare in a wartime situation, it's debatable, but the role of the press somewhat changes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, it was a very grave mistake to accept that term. I remember Bush saying, "I'm a war president." It was a very grave mistake for the press to accept that. Because it once again swooned into abject acquiescence, right? People in the press, Jill Abramson, for example, the one-time exec editor of the Times, would say things like, we're Americans too, you know. My reply to that is, if a journalist wants to be a good American, be a good journalist. That's good enough.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so the 2001 date was another quite fateful one. And once again, I don't think the press has recovered from the mistakes it made immediately after the September 11th attacks. Coming forward from there, the what we're talking about with the Russia stuff. And all that, there was animosity toward Russia way before Robbie Mook and the DNC email incident. This goes back to, I've had this in columns, this goes back to the 1830s and Tocqueville and Jules Michelet, the French historian, right? The two great powers, emerging powers in the world, those two and others noted very presciently, were the Russians and the Americans. Our givenness to look with hostility toward Russia dates that far back, believe it or not.
Well, it goes back and forth, doesn't it?
Push.
It goes back and forth. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the thing is, oh, well.
Well, be right, because if you take the Durante story, that's the total opposite of this.
Exactly. Story, so, you know, it's political expedience for a broader agenda. and you know, we really can't, and I know, I work for the networks, okay? You can't depend on the legacy press to tell the truth on these iron portfolio agendas. You
no,
cannot.
No.
And
no.
They have proven that over and over, and they're proving it.
What's
as
an iron portfolio?
As we speak, you know, the war,
right.
Wars, finance, banking,
right.
You know,
the big
issues. Yep. And I just...
I want to hear what happened.
My earlier point, if I may, was that animosity toward Russia, whether it was during the Tsars, the Soviets, or now the Russian Federation, is a very easy lever to pull. It's a sort of latent animosity. Even when things appear to be going well, beneath that, there is this implicitly adversarial attitude toward Russia in among Americans, right? And that's what happened with Russiagate. Again, it was going on before then. Washington was not pleased when Putin took over from, well, it was short-term hopeful, but when Putin took over from Yeltsin, in time it became clear that he was not going to be the pliant, inebriated leader that Yeltsin had been. And, you know, then the coup in Ukraine, that was a big incident, 2014. Russia reacted swiftly to our provocation there. So this was all in the wind before 2016, but it was readily available, you see, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a perfect vehicle, let's say.
Right.
So anyway, did anybody respond to this article?
Yeah, what was publication day like, the first day it came out?
I don't know whether Salon carries the comment thread in its archives. It's if I may say, Salon's archives are a mess anyway. But I think it had quite a fulsome comment thread. Other than that, I think I did a little radio. You know, I think maybe.
But nobody went up in arms, really.
Well, yeah. When did you get the first sense of trouble?
No. You see, the thing is, it hadn't kind of pierced the ceiling into properly mainstream press, right?
Right.
What I've discovered over the years is that you can say whatever you want in what we call alternative media.
As long as you don't reach the 100th monkey phase, you're okay.
Yeah.
You know?
But if you pierce the barrier.
Yep.
Indeed, if that piece had appeared in The Nation, I think a very great deal more would have happened, right? And so it's quite a good question you pose, but it leads me to suggest that at that level in the press, they're going to. You remember Gandhi's phrase attributed to Gandhi? I'm told he didn't actually say it.
There's a lot
first they
attributed
ignore
to
you,
Gandhi.
Then they attack you.
Mm-hmm.
No, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, and then you win. Right?
First they ignore you, then they attack you, then they laugh at you, and then you win.
Well, the alternative media in America, again, I don't like the phrase, and I'd love to share a few words with you two about it before our time is done. The alternative media in America is in the ignore phase, right? More or less, right?
It's like a caste system.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't I say a few things about alternative media?
Please,
why
I'm
don't
very,
you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Curious.
First of all, the term, I keep saying I don't like it.
I don't either.
I don't think there's any such thing as alternative media.
Exactly.
There's only media. There's only media.
Oh, well said.
There's rich media and poor media. There's new media. There's legacy media.
Mm-hmm.
There's corrupt media.
Mm-hmm.
There's principled media, but it's all media. That's
you're right. It's a terrible phrase.
And what I think, is going on around us now. Indeed, one might consider our very exchange this morning in this light, is that the corruptions of the mainstream or corporate press are such that they've become quite out of hand. And I say that after a very long time inside the mainstream media, that the responsibilities of what we're calling the alternative media are very considerable. It has a very big role, I would even say an outsized role, relative to its resources, right?
Yes.
But it is the place where accurate accounting of very important events is to be found now.
Yep.
And I think the extent to which it is important and making a difference is one measure. One measure of that is all this bleating about fake news. Fake news, in my understanding, or at least in the context we're discussing now, means nothing more than an alternative perspective confronting an orthodoxy that is wholly unaccustomed to challenge.
Well, what's interesting about the term fake news to me is that it's squishy in the sense that it can be applied to actual fake news, propaganda, what's being put out often by the legacy media. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it's also a term that is used against alternative, let's not say alternative, but other non-legacy, non-mainstream,
right.
And what they put out, since it's counter to the official narrative, that's fake news. So fake news has mutable connotations.
It's a very convenient phrase. I put it in the same file as conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
All you have to do is. We live in a time when labels are good enough for most people. Label something
weaponized.
And you don't have to even discuss it. If you label something a conspiracy theory, that's the end of the conversation.
And in a sense, that's what Arthur Miller was talking
about. Well, that was constructed
by
the CIA, the whole conspiracy theory thing.
Right, right. But I'm thinking about the crucible and the whole, you know, the idea that as soon as you point the finger, the job is done of destroying what you're pointing to.
Exactly. And I would say, without contest, the greatest conspiracy theory with us at the moment is none other than Russiagate, concocted by the very people who love to fling the word conspiracy theory around at everybody else.
And there's no such thing as dead wrong anymore after the Mueller report.
Yeah, but that's
nobody
part
even
of the
said,
operation.
I guess we were wrong and we have to have a bunch of panels and souls hand-wringing about being wrong. They didn't even do that.
The op is... You ascribe to others what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to get to. Okay. So, how did you move into this buzzsaw with your? Were you assigned?
Totally accurate reporting.
Exactly. You were assigned this by the Nation, or how did this happen? This a new report raises big questions about last year's DNC hack. How did you get into that? How did you find the sources to tell the story? Just tell your story.
I must say, I did not think that occasion at the time was anything other than another column critical of events. Typically my end of the garden is foreign affairs, but to cover foreign affairs these days you have to cover media, because whatever else is going on the foreign side, it's an information war, right?
Right.
You end
exactly.
up commenting about media, but just to go back a touch, I returned from nearly three decades abroad, most of them, but not all of them, in Asia, in 2010. And I detected immediately that Americans were absolutely eager, and maybe eager on the way to desperate, for a new accounting of America and its place in the world, its conduct and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to get that. I realized this is when I started realizing that post 2001, the craft that I entered as a pretty young guy much earlier had changed, right? I started writing foreign policy columns. And what I had to say was other than orthodox. And so I found myself at places such as Ceylon. And that was okay with me.
You were relegated, in other words.
Well, I think it was the natural order of things.
I remember when Ceylon was very bold and would go to both sides of the political fence and would touch third rail subjects and so forth.
Right, yeah. Right. So that's how I wound up there. I look back at the organizations where I used to work one or another time in my professional life, the New York Times among them, and I say, at another time in history, I might have climbed the ladder, I might have been assistant managing editor, I might have been whatever, foreign editor, who knows, but that's not the time we live in. The time we live in is such that I decided, actually this is perhaps the most useful thing I can say to you at this point, I decided at a certain moment, nothing more can be done within the corporate media. The moment has come, uncomfortable as it may be, difficult as it may be materially and so forth, you got to stand outside the tent. That's the only place you can get things said that
Bravo.
Are worth saying.
Bravo, my friend. Bravo.
You know, I love Lyndon Johnson's comment on this, the wonderfully crude Johnson. I'll soften it up for your listeners. You're either inside the tent urinating out or you're outside the tent urinating in, right? And I decided it's time to stand outside the tent, right?
Is that how you got... Well, how did you get to doing this article that caused the brouhaha?
Oh, that was my call. I was doing a column a week. Choosing carefully what I wanted to take up. And that was the obvious call that week. That was entirely me. One of the things I liked about Ceylon is that they left me entirely free.
No, I'm talking about the thing you did for Nation.
The Nation.
Yeah, how did you get assigned to do that? And it was approved, obviously. How did that happen? How did that go down?
All I did in that piece was report on the doings and findings of other people. I didn't discover anything, right? From all that happened afterwards, you would have thought that I had advanced some kind of, why not say it, conspiracy theory, right? Based on my own deep and thorough research or whatever.
Right.
I simply reported on the research of other people, professionals, cyber scientists and forensic people and all that, right? I've often said since then, I didn't do anything other than what a medium-level police reporter would do if he was covering some precinct or something. I just reported on what I saw, right? I did quite a lot of reporting. But that story was brought to my attention by the VIPS people, the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, VIPS.
So it was published smoothly in the Nation.
And I looked at their findings, and I decided it was time to write about them, right?
Right.
So you wrote it, and it was published with no. It was uneventful.
Everybody
so far, so far, so good.
Your editors approved it. Katrina approved it.
I'm not a great one for discussing internal stuff on that point.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Okay.
But it was published, mm-hmm. carefully edited, etc.
And then what happened?
There was quite a lot of. Disturbance following that. I guess you two are aware of that.
Well, I would like you to describe it for our audience who might not be.
If you care to, do you mind?
That was a very difficult time for me.
Yeah. I recognize your hesitation. I have a similar story, and there's something around it. Like Christina,
it's painful.
You know, we don't really tell each other what's inside that. You know, when it's trauma. It's there's
It's not a bad word for it. It was pretty rough going after that. I had to endure a severe and prolonged social media attack.
We know.
Oh, good. Thanks for following it all.
Yeah. I mean, we know what we've also been through. Yeah, we know what it feels like, and it's very traumatic. And I think we should devote a whole show in the future. You probably should.
You know, it's taken me quite a long time to get over all that. The press. I mean, the Times ignored, okay, but the Wash Post published on it, never took a comment from me, of course, that's par these days.
That's so outrageous.
You know, there was some reaction in the press, but a large measure of it was social media stuff. Some of the magazine, New York Magazine, did something, some kind of smear. It was really a smear, and it was my taste of something I had read about, but of course never went through. And that was the character assassination of those with whom one disagrees. Right? That's a pretty deep swamp. Right? It's a pretty bad aspect of our current political discourse, right? Going after people personally, right?
Yeah.
And through all of this, I kept saying to myself, they have no idea who I am, not a clue. They haven't bothered. It's all on my website, but they haven't bothered to look.
Let's have the address of your website real quick while we're there.
It's very simple. My name, patricklawrence.us, not .com, .us. And it's all there, right?
But, you know, I'll tell you, it's interesting to hear you talk about this because it reminds me of what happened to me when I was working at the networks. And you develop a very high cootie factor. Uh-huh. And people who were your talking to you or stopped by or whatever, now all of a sudden, you know, you're in the desert by yourself. And
it's
you feel like
dreadful,
your soul
you know,
has been...
I can tell by your description, you know what it's like. Yeah.
You feel like your soul has been sucked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you don't know what the hell has just happened.
Just happened.
Because I myself was reared in Haiti under the dictatorship of François Papadoc Duvalier. Mm-hmm. I went to the best journalism school in this country, okay. I thought I had landed in paradise, the free press paradise, when I went to CBS. And when the FBI came after me, when I was there, and I was then let go, because I was covering TWA Flight 800 in a way they didn't like. The explosion off the coast of Long Island of TWA Flight 800 for Paris. And actually,
very blurry event, right?
Yeah, and compounded with that was the fact that I was awakened to this crash. I was home because I had just completed a documentary on Fidel Castro for CBS. And I was home. I had gone home early. I was exhausted. I was taking a nap. My son, who was 10 years old, was an unaccompanied minor on Air France and on his way to Paris. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden my phone rings and my neighbor says, "Was that your son's plane that just went down?"
What's wrong with people?
Oh, dear.
And I can't...
That was supposed to have been harrowing.
I can't even describe to you how that felt. I felt like hot oil had been poured on my brain. Mm. And it was terrible. And I realized his plane was 5 minutes behind TWA Flight 800 on the same path. Okay, and I'll tell you something. That is why I have this show. That is why I published two books on the corruption of the press. That is why I am a whistleblower, because I was like, this is not going to stand. This is not going to stand. People get killed, no accountability. People, you know, are destroyed financially, personally, in every way. Physically, Gary Webb, you know, who committed suicide. Yeah, yeah. He was in my book, Into the Buzzsaw. He wrote the one and only personal account of what happened to him in that book. And I'll tell you,
talk about what happens to us. It's hard.
I crawled into a ball for a while, and then I just came out and I just said, you know what? I don't care what happens. I'm going to fight this. I'm going to fight this because without the truth coming out somehow, civil society is gone.
Yeah, you know where my mind goes with all of this? I think the task now is to keep sound reporting and accounting of events somewhere in the record.
Yes.
And not a very prominent place, regrettably, but it's in the record. And my mind goes to historians who maybe sooner rather than later, but at some point, the historians will have this record to work with, right?
But let me tell you why you ran into this buzzsaw, my friend.
Do.
Because you looked at the forensic evidence. That is inadmissible. You can report, he said, she said, this, that, and the other. But when you try and bring hard evidence to the table, and which is exactly what happened to me.
And to me.
Yeah.
Okay? When you bring hard evidence to the table, that is when the gigantic fly swatter comes to your, you know, is pointed in your direction.
Yeah, Hunter Thompson.
That is right. The bottom
you're very
line.
Very right. I had not thought of it from that perspective, but you're very right.
Hunter Thompson coined the phrase, the million-pound
shit hammer.
S-H-I-T. Oh, you said the word hammer.
Yeah, we can say it on TRM.
Okay. I just want to say something about The Nation. When I was buzzsawed, it was The Nation that fired the first shot. It was over how long was that piece? An 11,000-word expose of the pharmaceutical industry and HIV government science in Harper's Magazine. It came out in 2006. And there was a silence for it was a couple of days, and then it was, I won't name any names, but The Nation set the tone and fired the first shot for how I had to be taken down and destroyed. And after that, they were just all out of the gates. And it was just an absolutely vicious campaign. Harper stood by me and the piece. It's peace.
You're lucky. Not always does that happen.
But it didn't actually help very much. Then they were demanding that everybody resign, Lewis Lapp, everybody's supposed to resign from Harper's because there were a few AIDS activists and AIDS researchers that didn't like this piece. Well, I didn't expect them to like it. And it had to do with a very toxic HIV medication that went out to all these third world countries. So the buzzsaw often has several hundred billion dollar industry behind it.
You know,
but it also has this weird political, I guess I went against political correctness, not I guess, I did. So I feel like the problem is not when we say alternative media. I mean, I remember when Salon was alternative media, but I'll stop talking about Salon, but it's about the subject matter. What's the word I'm looking for? The certain subjects, the sanctity of never broaching, you know, never breaking the sound barrier on certain taboo subjects. And
right.
And you can't do that on Russiagate. It just goes down
unquestionable.
If I may interject,
please.
I think that I've been telling Ray McGovern and others, all the evidence required to take down the Russiagate story, all the evidence required is there.
Yes.
Right? the challenge is, and by all means, let us find more evidence, but the real challenge is getting this evidence accepted in mainstream media, right? That's the challenge. And I honestly think, given things that have been happening lately, that it's not that far beneath the surface, right? This could tip in the right direction. The Inspector General's report just published should be considered in this light. The reporting in the Legacy Press was terrible on this, but Glenn Greenwald, who has a law degree, constitutional law, wrote a splendid piece in The Intercept, taking the Inspector General's report apart accurately, and I'm telling you, the corruptions are all there. Right?
Nobody cares, though. They don't. Well, they care about one thing, and that is taking down Donald Trump. They don't care about anything
else.
Yeah,
you know, we all call it the Trump.
It's crazy. It's
right,
crazy because right. This is
literally
this
crazy.
Is another thing that drives me nuts about the American press generally. They always break everything down into left and right. Who gives a damn left or right? What's true?
I don't identify with these.
What's true?
Words any longer.
You know, it's crazy, and you know, the third portion of your story, which is this forum that mm-hmm. Nation decided to come up with, so that people could look. You know, they brought in five dissenters.
Right.
Okay, and again, what it makes me crazy. I'm an investigative reporter, and when I see the dissenters, I'm saying to myself, Jesslyn Radack. Isn't she a lawyer? She's a lawyer. They've got two drone people. Scott Ritter, I know Scott. Scott's a smart guy. He knows a lot of stuff. Is he a forensics expert in the computer area? I don't. So
no,
they.
My answer to that is no.
So who got to the
so,
Nation?
So they bring these dissenters who just have no credibility. And then they top it off with, I mean, they allow the VIPS people to respond to, and Thomas Drake, by the way, apparently was just destroyed by the fact that
he was working
he came
in an
forward,
Apple store.
He came, he was an NSA, no.
And
he,
no,
yes,
by the
yes,
end,
he was,
I'm saying by
the
time the
NSA, he came out as a dissenter, and he was the only other one who had worked for the NSA, but apparently he was like a software enhancement guy. He wasn't really
he was
a forensic
he was out,
guy.
He was out of his field of
he
expertise.
Was out of his li-
he's in the
depth.
Movie A Good American.
Let me make a comment about this whole matter of the forum and so forth. I urge the Nation to consider some such mechanism, okay? After the story was published and there was a great deal of dispute and all the rest we referred to earlier, I urge some sort of mechanism. I had nothing to do with how it was managed or formed, but the thought was there. And my thought was this. VIPS put some evidence on the table, the first hard evidence, right? Anybody who wanted should be permitted to come in and sit at the table and address the questions to hand. But at the door, they had to demonstrate that they had either supporting or countervailing evidence.
Yes.
Those VIPS people have always been open to countervailing evidence.
Yes.
What they did in the report we're talking about was a question of evidence to date, right? The evidence gathering process, forensics and so forth, goes on as we speak, years later, right? The mistake, I think, those in charge of that forum made was allowing these dissenters to speak when they had no evidence. I mean, I invite your listeners to read it. They didn't address the evidence that VIPS presented.
Exactly.
But they had something
but
that
not
Trump's
only the
evidence.
Matter of download speed, right?
Well, wait, they had the moral position
that question.
It's the moral cloud. They had the morally, that what was shaping up already as the acceptable right-thinking position
on
Russia.
Well, here's the thing.
That trumps evidence by this media in this age.
That's why forensic evidence is so dangerous. That's why I, for 17 years and counting, have been hammered on the TWA thing. Because I was looking at the forensic evidence. And then I finally put out that documentary with five or six whistleblowers, the government's own investigators who came forward to explain how things were undermined and who looked at forensic evidence they'd never seen before because everything was so highly compartmentalized. And they through the forensic evidence, came to a conclusion for the first time ever after 17 years. So what's going on here is when they bring in dissenters who don't know anything, it's not like they don't know what they're doing. Because it's not reporting to just bring on, oh, this guy disagrees. Well, it's like, who is this guy? What does he know? What's his expertise? When you have forensic evidence, there has to be expertise behind it. That's why these stories are so hard to cover. And just as recently as last week, I had a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, question me as a journal. Oh, my journalism, this and that. Oh, I thought you were a journalist. I thought this, I thought that. Because I sent him your article, and I sent him the VIPS responses. And he goes, well, I want an independent source who has no dog in the fight. I said, do you think VIPS had a dog in this DNC hack / download fight? They did not. They realized that the FBI wasn't looking into it for some reason, which was odd, okay? And the DNC hired, shady CrowdStrike. And so, they decided to look into it, and they brought in all kinds of people who weren't part of VIPS to help them do this. So, and right. he couldn't hear it or something. There's a willful blindness there.
That's a very fine phrase.
Then they start bizarre. These bullying campaigns.
Yes, exactly.
They're bullying campaigns. When a child gets bullied in school, is there a real reason? No, the signal just goes out in the crowd of kids. This kid's going to get bullied, and then nothing else matters. And the kid might think, well, maybe I'll wear something different today to school. It doesn't matter. Once the bully, this is how I see this phenomenon. It's rooted in really very frankly almost sadistic bullying, and they get and then who's orchestrating that certain. Now I'm not suggesting, Patrick, that you were bullied. I actually haven't invested.
Well, he was his credibility was attacked. Yeah, I call that being bullied.
I think it is bullying, and bullying sounds like a word applying to children, but it's actually there might be a better word than bullying. What word would you maybe choose? See, this whole thing is psychological warfare. And Christina, you're always, God bless you, talking about forensic evidence, but I'm always talking about psychological warfare and black magic and stuff.
You're talking about the mind bending.
I want Patrick to talk about what it felt like. What was it, in fact, that came after him?
After who?
And what came after you? It wasn't you had the forensic
what
evidence.
What came for you?
Yes, what came for you, right. What did it feel like, the spirit of it?
What I was watching for all along is what we're now talking about. Okay, neither I nor any of the people I was reporting on, who were named, had any investment in, the total veracity of what they found. Not to suggest they considered it in any way faulty evidence, but what I mean to say is they were open to the next step. They said numerous times, come, join us, help us out, let's take this further, what's the next step, where are we going, right? Your question is what came after?
In terms of what it felt like, was it a bully campaign? Was it when you were just thinking, what is all this about? Where was it coming from?
Bully. It's not a bad word, but it has a sort of schoolyard ring to it. I think it was much more than that. My mind goes back to the way dissidents were treated during the Cold War.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a lot more than bullying, right?
Vilification.
But, yeah.
Well,
you know, scapegoating, et cetera, et cetera. Character assassination, I'll take that, right? You know what? We're still standing.
Are you kidding? Stronger than ever. Stronger than ever.
And the American
I'm not
people,
letting this go.
The American public are beginning to understand, time and again, that journalist back there that was, we were all told, that discredited this. People are getting the formula now for how they do this.
Yes.
So
that's because people like us are explaining it to them. You know, it's interesting.
There's a playbook.
It's like little drops in the bucket. We're each a little drop in the bucket. Drip, 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 drip. And finally, you know, again, it's all going to be clear. But right now, it's the dark night of the soul because, I mean, I'm literally last week, this happened to me with my colleague. And my reaction was just, you know, un bel día, fratello. You know,
well,
one fine day, my friend.
Anyone who starts to say, what kind of journalist are you, is already over the
line. Well, that's what I told
him.
I said, you know what? Insulting me does not make you a good journalist. So, you know.
You're right or wrong. There's a fact that's correct or incorrect. There's no such thing as a journalist in that abstracted, lofty way.
Exactly.
It's just correct or you're incorrect.
But this forensic evidence, this VIPS forensic evidence, it's not going away. And I have been talking to Adam Carter. And yes, and he is going to aggregate in a website. We've been talking about aggregating in a website all this forensic evidence around this and bringing in new people who will also, again, people from all everywhere who have the expertise to assess this metadata are going to add to this. So then my friend who says, I want to know who doesn't have a dog in the fight, who has looked at this, it will all be there in one space. So I told him, Forensicator, Adam's stuff, everybody's stuff, VIP stuff, everything, everybody's stuff is going to go in this one place. So you can just click on a button and you can find that forensic evidence. And then, so
we're out of time.
We're out of time, but I have a special outro song for all of us here, for our past guests and our future guests.
Thank you. May I mention one thing?
Sure.
Would you two be kind enough to email me so I have your contacts?
Absolutely.
I'd like very much to remain in touch with you.
Likewise.
It would be an honor.
We'll be happy to do that.
Please do, yeah.
Okay.
So now your song.
Okay, Jess?
PatrickLawrence.com. Is that right?
No.
Patrick.
Okay, listen up.
Oh, they're clear.